If you only listen to our podcasts, I want to encourage you to visit unfetteredmind.org. Here you'll find, free of charge, dozens of original articles and contemporary translations of Buddhist texts and prayers. If you find these helpful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate so we can continue to expand the website and support your practice. Thanks.
Unfettered Mind, the nuts and bolts of self and no self.
One of the odd things about Buddhism in Tibet is that it took an esoteric tradition which was taught very, very much at an individual level when it first developed in India, and made it into a system for large numbers of people. There are quite a few contradictions that developed out of that. Today, we're going to turn to the second of the three topics. This one will be a little more straightforward for many of you because you were present at the retreat we did last year. It's the topic of Yidam, or deity. Now, historically, as the tantric systems developed, or tantric practices developed, there were steps into this kind of practice. So you had tantra as ritual, tantra as behavior, tantra as union, and tantra as supreme union. Well, we're not going to worry about that. We're just going straight to the heart of the matter. We don't have time, for one thing. The core insight of Buddhism, the thing that really differentiates Buddhism from most other traditions, and which created all kinds of consternation in India and elsewhere, is this notion of non-self. This is a theme that runs through, is central to every tradition of Buddhism. And it's not a belief. It is the understanding, the experience of everybody who looks deeply enough into what they are. And when I say everybody, I'm including all of the other religious traditions. What differentiates Buddhism is that, and I think one really has to attribute this to the genius of Buddha himself, Buddha Shakyamuni, Buddhism somehow never got stuck in a formulation that was rigidified into doctrine. So, in one sense, there was nothing that you absolutely had to adhere to. And so, every individual in every generation has been pushed and encouraged by their teachers to know through their own experience, which is very different from relying on the Quran or the Torah or what have you. Or the Vedas. Hinduism got stuck there. When we look very, very deeply, and all of you have had some experience with this, we look very deeply at what you are, what I am, one doesn't see anything. Or, to put it a little more accurately, one sees nothing. And as Lewis Carroll, Alice in Wonderland, I think it's Through the Looking Glass, actually, the White King and Alice are watching the race between the lion and the unicorn. The White King says to Alice, "Do you see anyone coming?" And Alice says, "I see no one." And the King says, "Oh, you've much sharper eyes than I have." And while one suspects that for Charles Dodgson it was a little more than a play on grammar, from a Buddhist perspective it really touches on exactly what is. Mahamudra prayer, it says, when you look at nothing and you look and you see nothing, and you understand the significance of not seeing. That's very important. Now, even though we may understand that intellectually, even though we may have some experience of it, most of the time we relate to experience with an identity of some kind or another, a sense of self, of being something. We have many of them, actually. We have all of the ones that come with being part, living in a society, parent, child, sibling, whatever our profession is, artist, poet, doctor, lawyer, plumber, massage therapist, you know, so on and so on. Salesman. We also have ideas about ourselves, which is another whole level of identity. So even though we may be a bank clerk, we kind of think of ourselves as a poet. And even though we are directing a corporation, we may think of ourselves as a humanitarian. And and so on and so on. And then we have another whole level of identities, ones that usually come from earlier in our lives or been shaped. I'm a person who does everything right all the time. I'm a person who never does anything right. I'm the best, doesn't matter what situation I encounter, I'm the best person for it. Doesn't matter what situation I encounter, I always do something wrong. I'm not lovable. Everybody loves me. These are, and you go on and on and on. I mean, you could take a poll here, different identities. You all know what I'm talking about, right? Now, the extraordinary thing is that even though we have this multiplicity of identities, and we actually operate as different people in different circumstances, with a different view of things, and different behaviors, so forth and so forth, we have the idea that there's just one thing. We don't even notice that we're switching personalities. We're like the shards of a shattered mirror, and we don't know when we move from the reflections in one shard to the reflections in another. So, this is a mess.
Ken, regardless of how stable my experience is in practice in varying degrees as I do Mahamudra and Dzogchen or Dzogchen, somewhere there's always a trace of an experience or of self. And what do I make of it and how do I work with it? It's really, how do I work with it?
What experience is the sense of self? No, what happens when you...
I don't know. I go empty.
Right. That's how you work with it.
And, but... And yet, it's still there.
Well, my sense when we were just sitting here is when I asked you that question and you looked, it wasn't, and then it came back. Was that right?
Yes.
Okay. And that's what happens. When our attention is at a certain level, often in that first instance of looking, we see, and we see nothing. But the attention doesn't stay at that level for very long because we lead very busy lives, we're easily distracted. It decays a little bit, and then that habituation of a sense of self reasserts. And we look again. And we look again. In any given meditation period, you're probably only going to be able to look a number of times before we run out of juice. And then we just rest and come back. In this way, we gradually increase the capacity of our attention so you can stay present in the looking and the attention doesn't decay. But what you see in that first instance is what is there, nothing.
In the course of practice and doing Mahamudra Dzogchen practice, I have a capacity to sit and not do anything. Mm-hmm. And stuff happens and stuff opens and, you know, and it's in there that the trace is, and I can have really remarkable and wonderful experiences, but at what point do I then say who's experiencing? Do you see what I mean? I mean, there can be a real stability on some level and a real openness. And yet, behind that, there's that trace. So at what juncture do I do that?
Well,
it's this niggling thing that just won't go away. And I actually kind of had a small insight into what part of it is.
Oh?
I just want to be someplace else. I mean, it's like, I think I don't want to be human.
You want to be someplace else.
This identity, that the effort is to lose identity, and there's something really off there in the way I'm approaching it.
Yes.
It's really getting corrupted.
You may recall the Mahamudra instructions. No distraction, no control, no working at anything. Sounds like you're doing fine with no distraction, but you're trying to control your experience and you're working at something.
It's the working at something.
Yes.
It's not the control, it's the working, and it's very subtle, and it's right here in the back.
Yeah. So what if you just stop working?
I don't know how. I mean, it's like sitting,
just a second. What if you just stopped working?
I don't know.
Then what happens when I ask that question?
Well, it empties, it goes blank.
I also sense that there is panic.
I'm not experiencing this panic. It's a little bit, it's maybe more confusion.
Yeah. Usually that confusion is what follows the panic, because for most of us, constantly doing something, constantly working something, we don't know what it is not to be doing something, however subtle. Mm-hmm. And the thought of not doing anything, of just being, is for many of us profoundly threatening. It's like we cease to exist.
And there lies the contradiction, because my whole intention is just that.
And this is the paradox at the heart of this practice. We have to make an effort and we can't work at anything. Now, there's only one way out of this.
I could die.
Well, in a sense, yes. But But it's by staying in that paradox, staying in that tension, that's the practice. And when we can stay there, something lets go. You can't make it happen. In a sense, that's what you're trying to do.
I just want it to happen.
Yeah. It sounds like you are looking for an ideal state. Remember, the aim of practice, in Buddhist practice, is not to achieve any ideal state. It is simply to experience whatever is happening right now, completely. So there you are with this niggling sense of self in the background. Experience all of that completely.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ken.
I'm Patricia from Venice, California. I'm curious, when you know that you have a pattern of telling yourself stories about certain things about yourself or in your life or in a situation, and you know by now that it is a story, that it's not necessarily foolproof reality, but your actions are still responding to the story, despite what your intellect knows. What practices do you think can help you the best to be more skillful when these stories keep coming up and sometimes, you know, when you kind of get into a loop with them?
Right. Well.
And when you believe them.
In mind training in 7 points, one of the instructions is learn to do the 3 difficult things. And the 3 difficult things are to recognize a pattern or a reactive emotion, to develop a practice to address that emotional reaction, and to continue with the practice until that emotional reaction is taken apart. What you are describing to me is that you've done number 1. But you may have a number 2, I'm not sure about that, but you aren't really at number 3. So that's kind of a framework. The story actually, as you know, all those thoughts and ideas that run into through your head, that's actually the it's the easiest manifestation of the pattern to recognize. It's also arguably has the working on that has the least impact. I mean, you can do a certain amount using cognitive techniques and saying changing one's language and things like that. Doesn't necessarily get at the emotional or the physical stuff. So what I suggest here, there are two techniques I can suggest. One is, and this just helps tremendously, actually quite a lot with the recognition, is you give the story a name. One of my students many years ago, whenever she thought of doing something good for herself, you know, like
asking for a raise or finding a better job or buying a house or buying a car or something like that. She would get these stories coming up in her, which says, if you do this, you will get cancer. Similar things. And so she nicknamed the story Dire Consequences. So whenever whenever that story arose, she said, oh, that's Dire Consequences again. And it just helps to name it. There's a very nice book on exactly this called Taming Your Gremlin by a guy called Dr. Carson, I think. He's a psychiatrist. So that's one technique. And that's just very helpful so that you aren't caught up in it all the time. From a meditation point of view, what I would recommend is a little different, and that is whenever you recognize the story is running, train yourself to ask, what am I experiencing in my body right now? Now, in the beginning, you probably won't notice very much. But you keep doing this, and you're going to begin to notice certain tensions or contractions or areas of discomfort in your body. And that's where you start to work. Because as long as we're flying around in the thoughts, it's very difficult to actually get any impact. When we start working with how it's stored in our body, then a lot of stuff can change. As you become aware of those physical sensations associated with the story, then little by little you'll also become aware of emotional sensations. And that's where the conditioning is stored, is in those emotions. As you develop the ability to experience those emotions, you'll find that the physical experiences begin to shift. And you'll also find that the power of the stories begins to wane, and you actually discover other possibilities of acting that are different from the stories. Because in the first stage of dismantling a pattern, we're able to recognize the pattern, but we can't see anything different. And then gradually we can begin to see other alternatives. Oh, I could do this instead of that. But we aren't able to do them. And then as we continue to practice, we get to the point where we're actually able to do them, to act differently. But that in itself requires continual effort. And that's the third one. We have to keep doing that until the pattern is completely, no longer has any influence on us.
Ooh, can I just ask a follow-up to
that? Sure.
I have actually, I do notice the physical,
mm-hmm.
and I have been noticing the emotions that come with it, but I find it excruciating to stop the physical sensation, which for me manifests itself in wanting to ingest anything around me, which is, I'm convinced why America is, you know, mm-hmm. as large as it is. But it's not, I mean, it's serious for me because it's insatiable. It's the hungry ghost. It's not a question of how much I eat or drink. It's just that physical urge to satisfy that emotion.
That's right. And it, as you say, it doesn't matter how much you eat or drink. The only way that you're going to resolve this is to experience the emotion. And yes, you use the word excruciating. It's very, very painful. So you do it in small doses, mm-hmm. and you build up your capacity. You don't try to do it all at once. And you don't. When you're working with very difficult experiences, there's another piece that I found quite important, and that is work with those as long as you can remain soft. As soon as you start to harden, go and do something else. Because when you're hardening with that, you're actually reinforcing the conditioning, and so you need to be able to sense that softness and suppleness in the relationship with what's arising. As long as that's there, then you can work with it. You can just feel it and experience it. But once you harden, then you're into another ball game. Okay?
Yeah.
Very good. Thank you.
We may have this already considered on the last, the other program that you're doing in your practice of compassion. But my question, when we're putting it into the first step, using the I form, may I be free of suffering, and this does relate a bit to what you were just dealing with the suffering. May I be free of harm and disturbance and suffering. And when I say that, I don't feel like I'm really tough enough to accept things as they are, and that maybe I cause my own suffering and need to look at that.
So what's your question?
Well, my question is that by using this form, am I not falling into trying to make things easy for myself? If I'm not trying to make God realms out of things, and I'm not, you know, looking for the assistance of Green Tara and St. Christopher, it doesn't ring right for me to use that form. I'm fine with going. I've not sat with that, and I feel I don't feel any.
How are you making things easy for yourself when you say, may I be free of suffering, harm, and disturbance? How are you making things easy for yourself?
Maybe I'm unable to distinguish it at this point, but I do see it as all as one taste, maybe. And when I look and see what I'm thinking of as suffering, usually I'm just out of whack a bit.
Okay. You're right. When we suffer, we're out of whack a bit. That's what suffering is. We're reacting to experience. We're not experiencing things just as they are. What's very important here is that we cannot think our way into this. We can't think, oh, this is how things are, so I'll just experience them this way. It doesn't work that way. Whenever we're thinking, we've actually created more separation. When we think we get lost in the world of thoughts, we cease to experience how things are, actually. So the purpose of this practice, of repeating these lines, is to create the conditions in us so that we can let go of thinking. Thoughts may arise, but we actually let go of thinking. And when we let go of thinking, then we experience everything in a very different way.
But in order to get there, I have to name it. And by naming it, I'm mentally, I'm into mind, or in the no mind.
Well, there are different approaches and different traditions. And there are different approaches because people have different capabilities. Some people can just sit and drop into awareness. And that's their form of practice. Other people, by developing such emotions as loving kindness or compassion or devotion, are able to drop into awareness and rest there. And other people, and I think for most of us, we have to work with how we experience the world and train ourselves. And often the training is long and quite rigorous. To let go of thoughts, let go of thinking, let go of thinking. And this is what we do with basic meditation. We breathe, thoughts come up, we get trapped by the thoughts or caught up by the thoughts. We recognize that, we come back to the breath. We do this over and over again. It's training, it's practice. And we train and train and train, and practice deepens so that when thinking arises, we're able to recognize it and drop. Recognize and drop. And in the beginning, that dropping only lasts for a second or half a second. But we keep practicing. And some of us have emotional reactions that are very, very strong. And so we actually work very explicitly on those emotional reactions. And you're quite right. It's a dualistic way of working. But it's a way which undoes the tightness of those emotional reactions. It creates a little bit of looseness in them. So then we can drop. If you can drop into natural mind, into natural awareness, that's fine, just do that. But for most people, they think they're dropping into a natural awareness or natural mind, but they're actually only dropping into an idea of it. They're dropping into thinking a certain way, a very subtle way maybe, but thinking. And that's not the same thing at all.
But indeed, isn't the purpose of the working with the four immeasurables really just to get it that we need to project compassion in this case. I mean, it isn't that we aren't already aware of it. It's simply that, but we need to do this, and this particular form of metta practice requires or gets you so that you have self-confidence by using this I form. And that possibly that is, maybe I already got the confidence.
Well, do you have the four lines there? Well, the first one, may I be free from suffering, disturbance, and harm. When you say that, what arises?
Oh, it's a very soothing thing to say to myself. Yeah.
And can you rest there?
Oh, yeah.
Right. And when you say, may those close to me be free from suffering, disturbance, and harm, what's that like?
I like it better.
What's your experience?
I like better even made the suffering that I'm feeling now not take form in those people that I love.
Well, yes, but now you're moving into something else. But let's go a step further. May those who cause me trouble and pain be free from suffering, disturbance, and harm. What arises there?
It's quite a reasonable request.
It may be a reasonable request.
And I mean, I'm not feeling any... I think I've worked with it enough. That's the story. That
okay.
I do.
All right.
Respond.
Mm-hmm.
And I know the effectiveness of it. And okay. I'm only really bothered by... And I'm not really bothered. I'm just finding it... I'm questioning the effectiveness of the I.
Well, for many people, when they say, may I be free from suffering, disturbance, and harm, some people experience a tremendous sadness. Tremendous sadness. Because no one has ever wished them that. Not even themselves until they say these lines.
Yeah.
Other people experience nervousness and agitation, which may seem very strange, but it's like, I wouldn't know what to do if I wasn't experiencing that. So all of those kinds of reactions point to certain habituated patterns in those people. But in Buddhism, we only use a tool as long as it's useful to us.
That's what I figured.
Yeah. And
it's not a universal panacea for...
There isn't a single meditation in Buddhism that is a universal, that's the right meditation for everybody. That's why we have, I mean, traditionally we say we have 84,000 teachings. Because we're very complex, and each person, as I was talking about in an earlier question, needs to find their own path. This is what Buddha said to do before he died, work out your own freedom. Buddhism is a set of tools, and we learn those tools through interaction with the teacher, through practice. And when we've learned those tools, then we figure out the tools that are useful to us and those we use. And we use them very, very deeply. And sometimes maybe we have to pick up one tool and put it down after a while and pick up another. But the point is to come to our own freedom. And whatever that path is, as we accumulate experience, we can tell what helps us and what doesn't. My own teacher used to say, the point of the Dharma is to benefit the mind. And that's something that I've always lived by. Okay?
Thank you.
Unfettered Mind retains all rights to these podcasts. If you wish to use part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.